Hi, I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits. Welcome to episode 26.
Episode 26.
Yeah. Now we're past quarter century.
Yeah, we're old now.
We still haven't figured out what the word is that you're trying to think of last week.
You know, like centurion or some shit.
It's except something. It wasn't last week. It was literally just like, it was literally an hour ago.
We only have one day to record episodes, okay?
Uno deo. We have real. I don't mean to say real jobs. We have actual day jobs. Yeah. I would love for this to be my, like, quote-unquote real job.
Oh, my God. If this was our real job, I'd put so much more effort into my stories.
I already put a lot of effort into my stories.
I know.
I would give you double stories every week.
I would give, like, three stories a week, yeah.
That would be so amazing. Yeah.
No,
we'll sponsor us, people. We'll do the stories.
Yeah, no one's paying us to do it yet, so.
Mm-mm.
I still got bills to pay.
But we still enjoy, we sure enjoy drinking.
We really do.
And researching.
And today?
Okay, yeah. Can you, because...
Okay.
I've already almost finished my drink, which I'm literally obsessed with.
I'll make another one. We have another pineapple juice open that I need to use. So.
Okay, well, I loved the one we made in our last episode. This was like our kind of fast and furious, mm-hmm. which is good because it's super easy to make at home, I think. So tell the masses what you have done.
I'll tell the people. So this... drink is called the SoCal Sunset. And you know what? You've probably drank this before.
I bet you have.
In Texas, it's called a panty dropper. And in some places, it's called the Malibu Barbie.
Oh, okay.
Also Malibu Sunset.
Yeah.
So it is 2 ounces of coconut Malibu rum. With probably 2.5 ounces of pineapple juice.
Yeah, that's about right.
Over ice. Not shaken, not stirred, nothing. Just over ice in a glass. And then you pour grenadine very slowly down the sides. The grenadine soaks to the bottom.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And yeah, so it makes this really pretty layered drink. And then garnish with 2 cherries.
That was legit.
The easiest thing. So fucking delicious.
And we put them in little... the cutest pineapple glasses.
Yeah. Seriously cute.
Seriously cute. So go check it out on Instagram, Killer Spirits Pod. Follow us for all of our drinks, drink pictures, and episode pictures.
You get lit on this.
I could. Mm. Because I've already finished it. And it's, I don't know, it just makes me feel like I'm sitting on a beach somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I'm not sitting on a beach at all.
Not even close.
Not even close.
It's probably going to rain today.
I'm probably not going to be sitting on a beach anytime soon. Aww. But yeah, make this for yourself and sit in your backyard under the sunshine. And it's delicious. And listen to Killer Spirits Pod.
And I love coconut everything.
I do too.
I'm like obsessed with coconut.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't like coconut, this is not the drink for you.
No.
But you could probably use regular rum.
Mm.
Don't you think? Or am I full of shit?
Yeah, you can just drink rum and pineapple juice.
See?
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah. So.
I'm a supporter.
I'm a supporter in however you decide to get the alcohol in your body.
Yes. Enjoy yourself.
Well, it was a very good idea. Thank you. We called it the SoCal Sunset, even though the fuckers that I'm talking about today don't deserve such a drink.
I have a feeling I'm going to be... this is the happiest part of her.
It's going to be. In fact, I actually want to give a disclaimer right now. On this episode.
Hmm.
It's extremely graphic. And there is sexual assault.
Okay.
And that's, I'm just saying that. So if that's, you know, you can move it along.
Trigger warning.
Go listen to the assassination of Julius Caesar. Yeah, because that one is just low key.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he dies and all, but we all know that story for the most part. So this is pretty gruesome. And, you know, I'm not saying everything, obviously, from this. But today we're going to talk about the toolbox killers. And so a couple of my sources, I used a book call the Toolbox Killers a deadly rape, torture, and murder duo. So that'll give you an idea of what this episode is about.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. And it's by Rebecca Lowe and Jack Rosewood. And then I also use Criminal Minds Wiki, which is a pretty good site. Mm-hmm. You know, I dabbled a little bit here and there in Murderpedia, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going to talk about them today. I really didn't know much about these guys before. So I learned more than I ever wanted to know.
I have never heard of them.
Yeah. So we'll talk about them.
I have no clue.
So first, let's talk about Lawrence Bittaker. Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker was born on September 27th, 1940 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His parents placed him in an orphanage, and he was adopted by George Bittaker. And it's really funny because I'm not really sure what his adopted mother's name is, because every source that I found was either Mr. and Mrs. George Bittaker or George Bittaker and his wife. So I'm not sure. She flew under the radar, had no name, apparently. But anyway,
I feel like that was common for women.
Yeah. George Bittaker and his wife adopted him while he was still an infant. And World War II, of course, had started when he was a little boy, and his adopted father worked in aircraft factories. And because of this, his job required the family to move around a lot.
Right.
So they moved from Pennsylvania to Florida to Ohio and then to California. At the age of 12, little Lawrence was arrested for shoplifting. And over the next 4 years, he continued to pretty much not give a rat's ass and kept right on shoplifting and doing petty crimes and those things. So, yeah, he started pretty young.
That's a nice child you have there.
He was known by the police, that's for sure. Okay. So Bittaker later said that he was only committing these kinds of things, like the thefts and things, to try and compensate for his parents not showing him love. And honestly, who knows if he was speaking about his adopted parents or his bio parents. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's unclear.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I said, it doesn't really matter because lots of people live in neglectful and even abusive homes and they don't go on to commit the shit that this monster did. So, you know, I'm sorry you didn't have love. And there's not really much known about his childhood.
And that's an easy, vague thing to say when you're under fire.
Yeah. So lots of kids move around a lot. It happens. I think we had another episode where I talked about that, where it was kind of like, well, I moved around a lot as a kid. Well, I'm fucking sorry for you. Like,
lots of people's parents are in the military.
Yeah. Lots of kids move around a lot. Lots of kids have very unstable homes and they don't go on to be complete monster heads. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just throwing that out there. So Bittaker apparently had an IQ of around a 138, which is very high.
It's like a genius, right?
Yes. But he hated school and he dropped out of high school.
Okay.
Okay. So, I mean, he was already doing all this other shit. Also, so not it's that not weird surprising. For
like genius kids.
True. So then he was like, you know, shoplifting is kind of small potatoes. I'll just start stealing cars, conduct some hit and runs, evade some arrests.
Okay.
And he ended up in the California Youth Authority, which no longer exists, mm-hmm. until he was about 19 years old. But his recidivism game was high, okay? And he was arrested by the FBI within days of his release.
The FBI?
Yeah. And charged with violating the Interstate Motor Vehicle Theft Act, because he went across state lines, I believe. And for transporting a stolen vehicle across state lines. Yeah. So
That is FBI.
That's the FBI, yeah. Yo. So he was found guilty in August of 1959 and was sent to a federal reformatory located in Oklahoma. And he was sentenced to 18 months.
Okay.
So he was actually transferred to a medical center in Springfield, Missouri during that 18 months because of his behavior. And I'm not sure exactly what that behavior was, but obviously it was enough to get him sent to a medical center. Mm-hmm. And once he completed about 2/3 of his sentence, he was released. So he wasn't even there the full 18 months.
Okay.
In December of 1960, he was arrested again for robbery and was convicted and sentenced to 1 to 15 years in state prison. Like, what a time span.
Yeah.
Like, just pick a better number. Like, give him
7 to 15.
Yeah, like
1 to 7.
Like,
3 to 7.
1 to 15. Like, that's like nothing to a lot. Yeah. I just don't understand. So he also underwent a psychiatric examination, and he was deemed to have, quote, considerable concealed hostility and was manipulative. And that despite his high level of intelligence, he was paranoid and borderline psychotic.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So in 1962, he had another assessment in which the psychiatrist noted he had, quote, poor control of impulse behavior. So we got him tested. We gave him all these diagnoses. And what is our response to all of that?
Bye.
Let's parole him early.
Yeah.
Great, right?
Get out of here.
Yeah. So in 1963, having served less than 1/6 of his maximum sentence, he was released. So 2 months later, he was arrested again for violating his parole and for the suspicion of his participation in another robbery. And the merry-go-round continued. Honestly, I could have gone on for like 4 pages on his fucking in and out bullshit that he did in prison, but I'm not going to do that. So he had multiple assessments that all said the same thing. He needed mental health treatment and he had violent tendencies. Okay. So you get the idea. Mm-hmm. In 1974, he went into a supermarket and attempted to steal a steak by putting it down his pants.
Okay.
And when an employee saw him doing this and tried to stop him, he stabbed the employee in the chest. And he was charged with attempted murder and shoplifting and assault with a deadly weapon. Okay. And he served only 4 years.
What?
Luckily, the employee survived. But
oh, God.
Yeah. Which is, I remember when I worked in a grocery store, they always say never engage.
No.
That's why. Because it doesn't seem like a big deal. Like, oh, I'm just stealing a steak. But you never know what they're going to do.
Hey, buddy, don't do that.
Yeah.
They could, like, flip out.
Yeah. So, yeah, he only served 4 years. Like, the 70s were wild, man. Like, that's all. Okay. All you can serve is 4 years after all of that shit that you just did. So, his incarceration. This is why you shouldn't feed me Malibu.
Today's a two-drink day.
Was at the California Men's Colony. At one point, during all these arrests, his adoptive parents basically picked up everything and moved to a different state, gave no forwarding address, provided zero information to him. They just left and never contacted him.
Oh, they knew.
They pretty much disowned him.
Yeah,
they were like, and goodbye.
We fucked up.
Mr. and Mrs. George Bittaker have left the state.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, whatever her name is. So let's talk about Roy Norris. Roy Lewis Norris was born on February 5th, 1948 in Greeley, Colorado. His parents were not married when he was conceived, but they did decide to marry after he was born because, you know, an illegitimate child at that time was legit a mortal sin.
Yeah.
As we saw clearly in Butterbox Babies.
Yes.
But they were not good people at all. They pretty much blamed him for their loveless marriage. Like, oh, if you weren't born, we would never have had to be together. Like, it's all your fault.
So don't.
Yeah. I know. His father worked as a scrapyard worker and his mother was a housewife but was addicted to drugs. And it's really unclear what drugs she was on. This was the early 1950s. I did a lot of Google searches on what drugs 50s housewives used to be.
Like pills? On.
And it said a lot about pills, so maybe that was it, but it's unclear what it was.
Hmm.
I don't know. I couldn't find any evidence of what exactly
drugs people were doing in the 50s.
I mean, there
was... Like heroin?
Yeah, I guess there was, but I feel like that wasn't really popular till the 60s. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. She found something. Whatever it was, she found it.
She had a good time.
Yeah. So he bounced around between his parents and foster homes. He kind of went back and forth. And he stated later in his life that he did suffer sexual abuse in one of the homes. So I am very sorry for child Norris. But that's really it. I mean, and that's the problem. Like, you hear about childhoods and you think, oh my gosh, that's so sad. But then it's hard to reconcile with the things,
right,
the people that they can become. Yeah. So he said that the times that he was in his parents' home, there was not enough food, not enough clothing. When he was 16, he attempted suicide by trying to inject air into an artery in his arm.
Okay.
Yeah, but he failed at that and was picked up by police who were just like, oh, you're a runaway. Let's return you to your parents, blah, blah, blah. Which, hello, could you see that this child needed help? But whatever.
That's kind of the choice they give you.
Hello. Hello, the 60s.
They're like, hey, do you want to go to a group home or do you want to go home? And it's like, well,
yeah,
I really have no choice now.
True.
Yeah.
So when he was 17, he dropped out of school, and in 1965, he enlisted in the Navy. In 1969, he was deployed to Vietnam, where he likely picked up some PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he was only there about 4 months and didn't see actual combat, but things happen. And he also discovered drugs really heavily while he was there.
Yeah.
So he began using marijuana, then heroin, and he was addicted. That same year, 1969, he was sent back to the U.S. into Southern California, where he stayed. Mm-hmm. So he decided, once he returned home, he was still in the Navy at this point, he decided it would be a great idea to force his way into a taxi that was being driven by a woman and attempt to rape her.
Okay.
So he was charged with rape, assault, and attempt to commit rape, and he served 3 months.
Oh, my God. Yep.
But he was discharged from the Navy on psychological grounds after this. Okay, right. That's fine. We're going to discharge you, but what are you going to do about it?
Nothing, apparently.
Nothing. Nothing was done. So he tried to assault another woman in February of 1970, and he was arrested again, but they let him right back out. Because, you know, assaulting women, is not, we'll just give you a slap on the hand. Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, like I said, no big deal. In May 1970, he stalked a female student at San Diego State University. He walked up to her on campus and hit her in the back of the head with a big rock. He hit her repeatedly until she fell to her knees, and then he bashed her head against the sidewalk multiple times while kneeling on her back.
What a psycho.
That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Did nobody see this happening?
Well, she did survive, and Norris was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon.
Yeah.
He was sentenced to serve 5 years at the Atascadero State Hospital due to his previous psychiatric assessments mm-hmm. that found him to have severe schizoid personality.
Fun.
He was released in 1975, placed on 5 years probation, and was deemed to no longer be a danger to others.
Fun.
Spoiler alert, they got it fucking wrong, okay? So, yeah, I doubt that, the 70s. Yeah. He was definitely a danger to others.
Yeah.
So just 3 months later, Norris attacked a 27-year-old woman walking home in Redondo Beach and offered her a ride on his motorcycle. And she was like, yeah, no thanks. So he parked, grabbed hold of the woman's scarf, twisted it around her throat, and told her he planned to rape her. And he did. He dragged her into the bushes and raped her. And she also survived, thankfully, and did report the rape to police, but it was a month before they found him. So the reason they found him is because the woman that he raped happened to spot his motorcycle and noticed the license plate number.
Oh.
So Norris was arrested and charged with the rape and was convicted a year later. He was sent to California Men's Colony to serve his sentence, and you can probably guess who he met there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's going to be like a Burke and Hare situation.
Yeah, these two fucking weirdos.
These two fucking weirdos in the whole fucking wide world. Well, they find each other.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in 1977, Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris meet, and they struck up a friendship in prison. On at least two occasions, Bittaker saved Norris from getting his ass kicked. And they even started making jewelry together. So, what are you going to do in prison, right?
BFFs.
Yeah. So, during all this bonding, they each started sharing their deepest, darkest fantasies. Norris told Bittaker that he found frightened young women extremely stimulating. He really got off on seeing the fear in their eyes while he raped them. Yeah, I'm sorry about your face. I'm not laughing at what I just said, but no, I told you this is going to be a rough one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, Bittaker was like, yo, new evil friend, if I ever raped a woman, I would, like, kill her so there's no witnesses and I wouldn't get caught. And Norris was like, wow, that's a magical idea.
Because Bittaker's the smart one.
Yeah. He's like, I've got 138 degree. I have 138 IQ, so let me tell you something, Norris.
Yeah, just kill them.
Because you keep getting caught because you're an idiot. So, Anyway, he thought that was a great idea. Bro, that's brilliant. We should hook up and start our own little partnership.
Oh, my God.
I mean, the thought of these two talking together makes me nauseous. It's so disgusting. So, They started hatching some plans for when they were released from prison. So they decided that they would murder girls from each teenage year, from age 13 to 19. Who the fuck knows why? That's what they decided. They planned to murder 7 young girls in total. And once they had decided on the victims they wanted, they next had to discuss their plans on the method of abduction. Both wanted to attack and rape girls, and both agreed that killing the victim was for the best. you know, so you're not going to get caught.
Okay.
So Bittaker was pretty much the one who was like, I want to try some torture. Norris was more like, I just want to rape. Whatever. But again, they came together and that's really what started to happen. Raping and torturing was the thing. So they talked all of this shit out while they were in prison. They vowed to keep in touch if one of them was released before the other. And Bittaker was the first one to be paroled on October 15th, 1978. He went back to Los Angeles and started working as a machinist, which actually earned him a lot of money. He was making about $1,000 a week in 1978.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a shit ton of money. And so he started making a lot of friends and hanging out with local teenagers. He's like 48 years old.
What?
This is 1978.
I did not realize he was that old.
But no, oh wait, no, he was 38 years old, sorry. Still. Because he was born in 1940.
He's hanging out with teenagers?
No, but yeah, I mean, he's still fucking old, sorry. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, he's 38 and he's hanging out with teenagers. He would make sure to always have marijuana and alcohol in his room at the motel that he was staying in to entice them to come hang out with him. Mm-hmm. What a creep.
Yeah.
So Norris was released from prison on January 15th, 1979, and he moved in with his mother in Redondo Beach. He started working as an electrician, and not long afterwards, he got a letter from Bittaker. Hey, you're out. That's great. So they caught up with each other at the end of February, and they started hatching plans again. Because they're like, woohoo, we're both out! Yeah, so these two idiots decided they needed a van.
You gotta have a van.
They needed a van. Yeah. So they combined their finances and purchased... Because
what's creepier than a fucking van?
Exactly. I know. I'll actually post a picture of it, too. It is really fucking creepy. Oh, my
gosh.
Especially for some reason, like, a 70s van seems more creepy than...
Is it like a panel van? Or is it like a VW bus van?
Oh, no. Not a VW bus van. Oh. No, it's a panel van. Oh. Yeah. yeah. So they combined their finances and purchased a 1977 GMC cargo van.
Oh, yeah. The worst.
The worst. Yeah.
That's definitely a rape van. Do yeah. not go near one.
In February 1979. It was silver. It had no windows on the sides, of course. It also had a large sliding door, as they do,
yes.
on the passenger side, which meant you could pull up alongside your victim and you don't have to, like, open the doors wide. You just slide it and grab. Slide and grab. Mm-hmm. Which is what they did.
That's also, I heard a tip recently that I never have heard, is that if you are parked in a parking lot next to a van that has one of those pull open things and they don't have any windows, get in on the other side of your car.
What if you're parked between two vans?
I don't know. Get in through the trunk.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. She was like, just get it on your passenger side and then go over to the other seat. Because
that's a good idea.
They will
idea,
like park in parking lots, slide open the door, and just grab you.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Just think about
being
it.
Being a woman. It is sometimes. Yeah. So, yeah. So they had their little van. They tricked out the back of the van with a makeshift bed, coolers. Yeah.
Tricked out.
They tricked it out. Coolers for cold drinks and a toolbox with a variety of items that could be used to subdue, maim, torture, and kill.
Sick.
Including a large sledgehammer and a pair of pliers, which would end up being Bittaker's favorite tool. Bittaker decided to nickname the van Murder Mac. Isn't that clever?
It's appropriate.
He's using that 138 IQ to the highest maximum, as you can see.
Yeah.
I fucking hate this lunatic. Like, if he was alive right now, I'd punch him in the fucking face. Like, yeah. I fucking hate that. Murder Mac? Really? Okay, so for the next few months until June 1979, they drove up and down the Pacific Coast Highway, kind of getting a lay of the land, scoping out the possibilities of kidnapping young girls. I'm not saying women. These are not women. They're These children. Are young girls.
Yeah.
They often parked at the local beaches and flirted with girls. Again, he's a 38-year-old man.
In a panel van.
And fucking Norris is like 30.
Yeah.
Okay. They took pictures with girls, would pick girls up, but they would let them go at this point because they were just practicing. They're doing dry runs. So Norris later claimed that they had done this with about 20 girls, but who knows what the actual number yeah. is. So again, the purpose of these dry runs was to perfect their plans.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's kind of see how this is going to work out. They also scoped out different isolated areas where they could take the girls once they kidnapped them. And they found a fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains, which is a remote place that overlooks Glendora.
Okay.
So the San Gabriel Mountains are a large mountain range located west of San Bernardino County and north of Los Angeles County. San Gabriel lies between the Mojave Desert and the Los Angeles Basin. To the east is Interstate 15 freeway, and to the west is Interstate 5, which we'd never call Interstate 5. We would always call I-5.
Yeah.
That's just how people here call it.
Yeah.
And I-5 was very familiar with, we're very familiar with, and also there's a lot of serial killers would roam and prowl the I-5.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Especially during the 70s and 80s.
It's just how I get to Disneyland.
Yes. And also, I mean, that was during the time when a lot of hitchhiking was happening.
Right.
You know. So Bittaker liked this area because it was remote, so no one could hear anything. But also, he felt it would be easy to get rid of the bodies there. It would, because no one would find them. So on June 27th, 1979, Bittaker and Norris found their first victim. Her name was Lucinda Lynn Schaefer, which is the cutest name in the world. She was also known as Cindy. She was only 16. She had blonde hair, blue eyes. She was literally so beautiful. I'm going to post a picture of her. She was so gorgeous. And the fact that she was just a baby is so horrific. So she left a church meeting in Redondo Beach and was walking to her grandmother's house. Bittaker and Norris spotted her around 7:46 p.m. She was wearing a white blouse with black embroidery, dark blue jeans, and beige sandals. So these assholes had spent the day at the beach drinking beer, smoking marijuana, chatting up teenagers. And when they saw Cindy, Norris said to Bittaker, quote, "There's a cute little blonde." So they pulled up alongside Cindy and tried to get her in the van with offers of marijuana and a ride home. Cindy declined. She was like, "Yeah, no thanks." And she carried on, kept on walking. So they drove ahead of her and parked beside a driveway. Norris got out of the van, opened the sliding door, and he was like leaning in, probably making it look like he was doing something in the van.
Right.
You know, like
looking for something.
Just totally nonchalant, blah, blah, blah. So Bittaker stayed in the driver's seat. And as Cindy got close to the van, Norris grabbed her and dragged her into the van. And she actually lost one of her shoes on the pavement, which would later be found as evidence of her kidnapping.
Oh.
But that was all the evidence that was found.
Yeah, she just disappeared.
So once the door was closed, Bittaker turned the radio up to full volume to drown out any of her screaming. He quickly tied up her legs and arms, and he used duct tape to gag her. And then they made their way up into the mountains. So again, just a little spoiler alert, we're going to get to the really bad parts now.
Okay.
Okay. I'm letting all our listeners know too. So you can, you know, prepare yourself or not.
Yeah.
So when they reached the fire road, what's happening over there?
Are you dropping?
You're all upset. Okay. So when they reached the fire road, I lost my place, April, because
sorry. I was trying to, cut the tension out.
Okay, yeah. So they went up to the mountains, the place that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So they had found this fire road, and I don't know if I actually explained this part, but when they first found it, there was a gate with a lock on it, and they ended up breaking that lock and opening the gate and just going in at free will. I don't know why. Probably because they would, if it's a fire road, they would use it if there was fires, but mm-hmm. it wasn't used very often.
Yeah.
So that was their choice place. So Norris told Bittaker to go for a walk for an hour, and he raped Cindy. After an hour, Bittaker returned to the van, and then Norris disappeared while Bittaker raped her. So then Norris came back and raped her again, and while Bittaker was away, Cindy asked Norris, "Are you going to kill me?" So he said no, but she said, "If you do plan to kill me, please let me pray beforehand."
Oh.
I know, this literally breaks my heart. So later, when they had their testimonies or whatever, according to both of them, they actually argued over whether she should be killed or released. We don't know if that part's true. This is just their fucking flapping mouths, but possibly they did, but they gave different answers as to who was for what and against what, because they were all against each other later, which we'll go into, but So either way, Norris actually tried to strangle her with his bare hands, but he couldn't handle the look in her eyes, so he ran off and vomited. That's his story. So Bittaker took over the strangulation and continued to squeeze her neck until she collapsed and started to convulse. Bittaker retrieved a wire coat hanger from the van and twisted it around her neck with the vice grip pliers until she stopped moving. They never gave her time to pray.
Yeah, clearly.
So they wrapped her body in a plastic shower curtain, and her body was then thrown over a steep canyon. Norris later said that Bittaker had assured him that there'd be no evidence because wild animals would eat her remains and there'd be nothing left. Like, trust me, dude, this is the best idea. So later, even though Norris and Bittaker, spoiler alert, they are convicted of Cindy's murder, to this day, her body has never been found, which is very heartbreaking for her family. Never been found. That shoe, like I said, was it. That was all that was found of her disappearance. So 2 weeks after murdering Cindy, on July 8th, 1979, Norris and Bittaker spotted Andrea Joy Hall, who was hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. She was 18. She was also blonde with blue eyes. She was wearing a one-piece burgundy bathing suit and blue terry cloth shorts. So they actually pulled over to pick her up, but another car beat them to it, and she got into that car. And they're creepy as fuck. So what did they do? They followed this car until she got out of it.
What?
And, yeah. So, and this time they kind of changed up their you know, orientation in the van, and Norris hid in the back because they wanted Andrea to think that Bittaker was alone in the van. Like, maybe she'd be more trusting. Like, oh, it's just one dude.
Yeah.
So Bittaker pulled up to the van and actually offered her a cold drink, which it was hot. I mean, it was fucking July.
Yeah.
And she'd been outside. So she did accept it. And while he was retrieving the soft drink from the cooler in the back of the van, and it was starting to hand it to her, Norris suddenly opened the van door and tried to pull her in. She actually gave up a hell of a fight, but he was able to pull her inside. So Norris bound her ankles and wrists and placed tape across her mouth to gag her. Again, they drove to their favorite fucking spot in San Gabriel Mountains. Bittaker raped Andrea, followed by Norris. When Bittaker was raping her a second time, Norris actually thought he saw headlights from a vehicle. So Bittaker put his hand over Hall's mouth to keep her quiet and dragged her into some bushes because they thought a car was coming. Mm-hmm. So Norris drove the van away while they hid, like he hid her in the bushes. I know, they're so fucking stupid. So they never saw the vehicle, but they decided to go further into the mountains just in case there was someone there.
Sneaking around or whatever.
Who knows?
Doing the same shit they were doing?
At one point, Bittaker forced Andrea to walk up a hill alongside the road naked, and he sexually assaulted her again. And then she was ordered to pose for Polaroid pictures.
Gross.
So back in the van, they drove to the other location in the mountains. And while Norris left, like he went to get alcohol or some shit, Bittaker forced Andrew to walk up another hill. And by the time Norris returned, Bittaker was by himself and there was no Andrea there. There was no sign of her. So he did have two more Polaroid pictures of her, though. And of course, we can't see these pictures, but there are descriptions of them. And she looked completely terrified, of course, in those photos. So Bittaker told Norris he had instructed Andrea to give him as many reasons as she could think of to be allowed to live. You know, he just got off on this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
This part's really bad. I'm just preparing you, okay? It's even hard for me to say. That's how bad it is. He then thrust an ice pick through her ear and into her brain. He turned her body over and drove the ice pick into her other ear, this time stomping on it until the handle broke off.
Jesus Christ.
Incredibly, she was still alive and conscious. So Bittaker strangled her and then he threw her over a cliff.
Holy cow.
A literal monster.
Yeah.
I have no words for that. So her body has also never been recovered, even though they were also convicted of her murder as well. But her body has never been recovered either.
Mm. Were they convicted because they confessed?
Yeah, and we'll definitely get into that. Okay. I'll get into all that. So on September 3rd, 1979, friends Jackie Doris Gilliam, who was 15, and Jacqueline Leah Lamp, who was 13, were sitting at a bus stop near Hermosa Beach. They'd been hitchhiking along the highway and were spotted at the bus stop by Bittaker and Norris. They were literal babies. I cannot. 13. I mean, that's it's crazy. So they offered the girls a ride, and they accepted. You know, again, it's summer, mm-hmm. and hitchhiking was a thing. It was a total thing back then. So once they were inside the van, they were offered marijuana. They accepted it. Jackie and Jacqueline realized pretty quickly, though, that something was not right because the van veered off the highway and was headed into the mountains. Mm-hmm. And they protested the change of direction. Like, what are you doing? Where are you going? And they, Bittaker and Norris, were kind of like, no, it's fine. You know, trying to like calm them down. But they both knew something was up. And Jacqueline especially, I think she was a little spitfire. She actually tried opening the sliding door while the van was in motion to escape. So Norris struck her on the back of the head with a bag full of lead weights.
Jeez.
She was knocked unconscious briefly, which gave Norris enough time to subdue Jackie. Norris was in the process of binding and gagging her when Jacqueline woke up and tried again to get out of the moving van. Because she's like, I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
She made it out, but he twisted her arm behind her back and dragged her back inside. So, of course, Bittaker was like, oh, shit, we've got all this shit going on. People are going to see it. So he stopped and jumped in the back to assist Norris in subduing them both. He punched Jacqueline in the face and tied both girls up and gagged them. Then he proceeded to their, again, favorite isolated area. And Jackie and Jacqueline were kept for 2 days.
Oh, my God.
In the van. Yeah. So during that time, they were both beaten and raped repeatedly. They took turns actually sleeping in the van next to the girls. Like, one would sleep in the van and one would keep watch. Mm-hmm. At one point, Bittaker made Jacqueline walk up a hill and pose for pornographic pictures with his fucking Polaroid.
What is the deal with that?
I don't know, but I feel like every Polaroid picture I've ever seen out, there's so many creepy Polaroid pictures.
Yeah.
It's just horrific. And again, you're not going to see these anywhere online.
Yeah.
Just FYI. they're not there, thankfully, but they were part of evidence that were that was taken when they were captured. So when they returned to the van after posing for pictures, he instructed Norris to take Polaroids of himself with Jackie with clothes on and naked. So he's just orchestrating this whole thing. And during one of the many times that Bittaker raped Jackie, he made a tape recording of the attack and made her pretend to be his cousin. So this is another thing. He really got off on some weird shit, and he tape recorded a lot of the torture and a lot of the rapes.
Okay.
Which thankfully would be his downfall too, but it's disgusting.
His cousin?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he used an ice pick to stab her breasts and tore off part of her nipple with the vise grip pliers. And when it came time to murder them, like, there was a time, right? But mm-hmm. Norris claimed that he said Jackie should be killed quickly because she'd been cooperative. But Bittaker stated, quote, they only die once anyway. So she was strangled to death after having the ice pick thrust into each ear. Bittaker struck Jacqueline on the head with a sledgehammer and strangled her. And their bodies were thrown over an embankment.
Jeez. Did they ever find their bodies?
Yes.
Okay.
They will be found, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So on October 31st, 1979, 16-year-old Shirley Lynette Ledford was standing outside a gas station trying to hitchhike home after attending a Halloween party. Bittaker and Norris pulled up and offered her a ride home, and she accepted because she actually recognized Bittaker. He would come into a restaurant that she worked at part-time. So she's like, oh, hey, it's my customer, blah, blah, blah. So as soon as she got in the van, they offered her some marijuana. She was like, no, don't want that. Bittaker drove down a secluded street, and Norris threatened her with a knife so he could tie her arms and legs and gag her with the tape, per usual. Then Norris took over driving, and Bittaker got in the back of the van. So as they drove around for more than an hour, Bittaker untied Shirley and removed her gag, and they then proceeded to torture her. And I'm not going to go too deeply into what was done to her here. It is massively horrific. I will say that she was their last victim. And Bittaker used his favorite tool, pliers, inserting them in different parts of her body, giving her horrific injuries.
Okay.
So this entire incident was captured on tape. He had the tape, he had the recorder on as soon as he entered the back of the van. There is a transcript of this tape that you can read in the book that I mentioned at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not going to read it here. I will warn you, it's one of those things you can't unread, mm-hmm. if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The actual recording of this was played in the courtroom during the trial, and jurors were weeping.
I bet.
When they heard this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you really want to read it, go get the book. The book is amazing anyway. They go really deeply into a lot of the psychology of partner killers, and there's a lot more information in there. So, you know, of course, I always suggest reading that. There's a lot in there. But anyway, she was tortured and raped over 2 hours before she was strangled with a coat hanger. And this time, they didn't even try to hide her body. They dumped her on someone's fucking lawn. Oh my God. Like, boop. And they never even went up to the mountains. They just drove around and did it. So when her autopsy was performed, the list of injuries she sustained were as follows. Compression marks on her neck, petechial hemorrhages, blunt force trauma to the head, blunt force trauma to the face, blunt force trauma to the breasts, tears of the vaginal lining, tears of the rectal lining, multiple fractures of the olecranon, which is the elbow, lacerations of the fingers, and puncture wound of the hand. So, yeah, she had a horrible death.
Yeah.
So, obviously, forensic science wasn't what it is today. I mean, it's 1979. Right. So, even though Shirley was found very quickly, there wasn't much evidence at the time to point police in the right direction. But thankfully, these two were idiots. And Norris also couldn't keep his fucking mouth shut, which ended up being their undoing. So back in September 30th of 1979, so like a month earlier, mm-hmm. Norris and Bittaker had kidnapped another young girl by the name of Shirley Sanders. And Shirley Sanders was visiting California from Oregon to spend time with her father in Manhattan Beach. She was walking along the road when they pulled up alongside her and asked if she wanted a ride, their usual stupid-ass MO. She declined and kept on walking, just like Cindy. Mm-hmm. And so they stopped the van and sprayed her with pepper spray and dragged her into the van. Because they will not be
told no.
Told no.
Right.
So they took turns raping her in the back of the van. And at one point, Shirley Sanders saw the opportunity to escape and she took it. She got out of the van and basically ran for her fucking life, thankfully. And they were unable to catch her. So she immediately reported the attack and rape to the police, but she couldn't identify them then. And she hadn't taken note of the license plate.
Right.
I mean, hello, trauma.
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't take note of the, I mean, how no, could you know?
I didn't happen to have a I'm pen sorry. Handy.
Yeah, I didn't do that. I was literally being raped.
Yeah.
So the only information that she could give them was that the van was silver.
Okay.
So this is why there was kind of a month between her and the next victim, Shirley Ledford, because they got really worried and skittish mm-hmm. during that time. I think at one point, I think Bittaker even moved where he was living and went and lived somewhere else, though Norris still stayed with his mom.
I can't believe they only laid low for a month.
I know, right?
Pieces of shit.
But, I mean, they were getting more and more, right. Like, the timing was getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
So that was really why there was a month there. They started to get worried, but then they were like, oh, well, nothing's happening, so blah, blah, blah. So... In October, Norris also ran into an old prison buddy named Jimmy Dalton and immediately started bragging about all the shit he'd been up to.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So Dalton was like, okay, dude, whatever. Like, probably didn't really believe him.
You're the same sick fucking weirdo that was in prison with
right,
me.
But that sounds like a lot of shit. I don't really believe you.
Yeah.
But then Shirley Ledford's body was found and it was in the papers and Jimmy Dalton was like, fuck. this kind of sounds like what he was telling me about.
Yeah.
And then he was also like, fuck this shit, and went to the cops.
Oh, that's good.
So Paul Bynum was the detective in charge of Shirley Ledford's case. And Jimmy Dalton told him Bittaker and Norris were driving around in a silver van. And that got his attention because he actually remembered the statement made by the rape victim, Shirley Sanders,
right,
that the van she was dragged into was silver. So they showed Shirley Sanders a lineup of photos, and lo and behold, she chose fucking Norris and Bittaker. Mm. The cops put them under surveillance, and Norris, being the idiot that he was observed selling marijuana on November 20th, 1979. And because he was already on parole, this was actually a violation of his terms.
Yeah.
So they arrested him, and then they arrested Bittaker. And they were both charged on suspicion of the rape and kidnapping of Shirley Sanders. Mm-hmm. So they weren't in jail very long before Norris started singing like a little canary bitch.
Oh.
Which usually happens.
Yeah.
It's all Bittaker. He did everything. I didn't do anything. I don't know anything about this. Okay, well, he did finally admit to some of it, but really tried shifting the blame solely onto Bittaker.
Right.
Like, well, I was there, but, you know.
I just drove the van.
Yeah, I didn't. I wasn't really into
this. He made me do it.
Yeah. So when police searched Bittaker's motel room and Norris's house that he was in with his mother, they found 500 Polaroid pictures of 500 young women and teenage girls, many of which had been taken at Hermosa Beach and Redondo Beach, though some were taken at a local high school. What the fuck? I mean, so among these pictures, and I don't think all of them were like of rape victims, but among these pictures were Polaroids taken of Andrea Joy Hall and Jackie Gilliam. Mm-hmm. So police found several bottles of acidic materials, and Norris told the cops, oh yeah, we were going to try to use those next time when we tortured somebody.
Nice.
Yeah. So inside the van, there was also a large number of items that could be linked to the murders. They found sledgehammer and a bag filled with lead weights. They also found a book which detailed how to find police radio frequencies. They also found a book which, they found a book. Mm-hmm. Necklaces belonging to two victims were found along with a jar of Vaseline, which just makes my stomach curl. I can't. I just fucking hate Vaseline now. So the most disturbing piece of evidence was an audio tape recording of the murder of Shirley Ledford, which I talked about earlier. Mm. Her voice was identified by her mother, which just shatters me into a million pieces. And of course, the voices of the two men were identified as Norris and Bittaker.
Yeah.
At the home of Norris, a bracelet was found that had belonged to Shirley Ledford, and he'd taken it as a souvenir. And after confessing, he said he would assist detectives in finding the bodies. So they actually all went up in the hills together, blah, 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 a la chicken coop murders.
Yeah.
And sorry. And he, even though he took him to the area, there wasn't much found. Andrea Hall's body was not found. Cindy's body was not found. On February 9th, 1980, the skeletal remains of Jacqueline Leah Lamp and Jackie Gilliam were discovered near a dry riverbed at the bottom of a canyon. Mm. So they were discovered. The bones were scattered over a large area, most likely due to animals.
Yeah.
So when the skull of Gilliam was found, the ice pick was still embedded in the bone.
Oh, God.
I know. So Lamp's skull had multiple denting injuries from the sledgehammer blows inflicted by Norris. And despite not finding all of the bodies, there was enough evidence for both Bittaker and Norris to be charged on multiple counts, including 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder based on the forensic evidence the investigators had. And the crux of it, Norris's confession.
Mm. Right.
So after they had been formally charged, both Bittaker and Norris were arraigned. Norris had a bail of $10,000. I'm sorry, even in the 70s, that doesn't seem like enough to me.
Should be no bail.
No bail. Bittaker was denied bail.
Yeah.
But, like, what the fuck? So within a month of being charged, a plea bargain was offered to Norris in exchange for testifying against Bittaker. The deal meant the prosecution would not seek the death penalty or life imprisonment without parole, provided Norris kept up his end of the bargain.
Here's the thing, though. A plea deal like that is such bullshit because they both did the same thing.
I know.
I've never understood it. So whether Hugh rolls on the other one or not, they both did it.
It's always who's going to talk first. That's all it is. That's all it is. Because what if Bittaker walked in and said, I'll talk?
Yeah, they both are fucked up.
I know. So, which is funny because I feel like...
I would think that's death. That's capital murder, I would think. Both of them.
Oh, absolutely. 100%.
Like, that's what you use it on.
Yep. That's what you use it on.
That's what it's for.
That's literally what
it's for. The ultimate, most heinous.
Yeah. So, naturally, in an effort to save himself, Norris agreed to this deal and took it.
He's a fucking coward.
He is. Okay. Oh, totally. So, Bittaker refused to plead guilty.
Okay.
Like, fuck you.
That makes sense.
On March 18th, 1980, Norris pled guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of second-degree murder, 1 count of robbery, and 2 counts of rape. His sentencing happened on May 7th, and his probation officer testified that Norris showed zero remorse for the crimes he'd committed, and Norris was sentenced to 45 years with possibility of parole, because that was part of his deal. They couldn't give him a sentence without the possibility of parole. That was part of the deal.
45 years is a lot, though.
Yeah. Not long enough, in my opinion, but okay. So Bittaker went on trial on January 19th, 1981 in Torrance, and the presiding judge was Judge Thomas Fredericks. The star witness, of course, Norris. Your face.
Okay.
Yeah, and he took the stand on January 22nd and basically threw Bittaker under the bus about 3,000 times.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's all him.
Yeah.
Which, good, whatever. I mean... I don't know. So Bittaker took the stand on February 5th, 1981 to testify on his own behalf. And his story was that Norris was the bad guy and he had no knowledge of Cindy Schaefer's death. And as far as Andrea and Jackie and Jacqueline were concerned, he actually paid them for photos and sex and let them go. And I never saw him again. I don't know what happened to those guys.
Right.
So remember that tape that I talked about of Shirley Ledford's torture?
Mm-hmm.
Just before having to play that tape, prosecutor Stephen Kay addressed the jury and spectators and said, quote, if you don't know what hell is like, you're about to find out, which kind of gives me chills.
Yeah.
So Bittaker's trial went on for 3 weeks and closing arguments were made on February 10th. When prosecutor Stephen Kay addressed the court, he apologized that he could only ask for the death penalty and that unfortunately there was no legal way to make sure Bittaker endured the same torture and suffering he had inflicted on the young girls he had murdered.
Hey.
I feel like this guy was fucking dynamic as fuck.
That's a good closing argument.
I love it. So on February 17th, Bittaker was found guilty of 5 counts of first-degree murder, 5 charges of kidnapping, 9 charges of rape, 1 charge of sodomy, 2 charges of forcible oral copulation, 1 charge of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and 3 charges of unlawful possession of a firearm. The jury did sentence him to death. So formal sentencing took place on March 24th, and Judge Fredericks imposed an alternate sentence in case his death penalty was ever converted to life.
Oh.
Of 199 years and 4 months.
Good.
The judge was like, let's just lock this shit down. Because I don't always trust that, you know, because a lot of times they are converted.
Right.
They do convert it. So... that I thought that was interesting. So his first execution date was set for December 29th, 1989. Of course, he appealed. On June 11th, 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the decision to execute him.
Mm-hmm.
The next date for the execution was meant to be July 23rd, 1991. He appealed again. And then a stay of execution was granted on July 9th, 1991. Norris became eligible for parole in 2009, and he was denied.
Good.
He was also denied parole again in 2019, and he ended up dying on February 24th, 2020.
Hmm.
And Bittaker, although never executed, he did remain on death row and died in 2019.
Hmm.
So.
Good riddance.
Good fucking riddance. An interesting side note. During his prison term, Bittaker spoke with Laura Brand, who is an investigative journalist, and she also studied forensic psychology in college. She's actually interviewed over 50 serial killers. Yeah.
Hmm.
I read somewhere that they actually call her like the serial killer whisperer. Okay. Which is a terrible name, but I mean, I kind of strange get the gist of what they mean.
Quality to have.
But I mean, actually, she's really cool to read about because her goal is really to get as much information as possible from killers and hopefully discover new information on unknown victims or unidentified victims.
Right.
So she spoke with Bittaker multiple times 6 years prior to his death, and he gave her tons of information. He even like gave her maps outlining where possible bodies were.
So there was more.
Yeah. He even drew a separate map of where he buried evidence that had never been recovered. Wow. So I don't know if there was more, but there was definitely Cindy and Andrea who were never found.
Right.
So at that point in time, you know, before he died in 2019, the maps hadn't been accurate and the body still hadn't been found. But Brand was working with the district attorney's office to kind of help pinpoint the exact locations. Mm-hmm. She also says that the areas that Bittaker had been pinpointing on the maps were never searched during the initial investigation, and she was hopeful that with today's technology, it may be possible to find more evidence and possibly the bodies of Cindy Schaefer and Andrea Hall. And she actually is writing a book about her talks with him, and it's called What Hell Is Like, The Untold Story of the Toolbox Killer. Wow. And her title's a little nod to Stephen Kay's address to the jury prior to hearing that tape. And there's no release date yet, but I'm really looking forward to reading this because I feel like she put a lot of time and research into this. And also, there might be some new information that's in there. So I will report back when I see a release date on that because I think that's really interesting.
Maybe you can do a second podcast with some new info.
Maybe, if there is some, but yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to give her a little shout out because I read some stuff about her I thought was pretty cool. And I also wanted to touch on really quickly two important organizations that I've looked into. I think there was another episode that I did too where I kind of looked into this, but one is called the Charlie Project. And the Charlie Project profiles over 14,000 cold case missing people, mainly from the United States. And it doesn't actively investigate cases, but it's a public, like a publicity vehicle for people who are searching for missing people who are often neglected by the press and forgotten.
Yeah.
So you can get on there, you can do searches, you can share information. It's really cool. And there's another one called the Doe Network. I feel like you should have heard of this or haven't. Okay. They're pretty famous. So if you're listening, you've heard of this, but it's an amazing organization. It's 100% volunteer. And it's devoted to assisting and investigating agencies and bringing closure to national and international cold cases concerning missing and unidentified persons. So they have done a lot of amazing things.
Oh, like DOE, like D-O-E.
D-O-E, yeah. DOE, yeah. You know, like Jane Doe. Yeah. Especially like, you know, bodies that have been discovered and they haven't been identified. They really try to match cold cases and unidentified persons with missing persons.
Gotcha.
So go check them out. You can do a search. You can also provide information if you know any information about a case or, I don't know.
You know some guy that got out of prison and is telling you all this weird-ass shit that he's doing?
Well, yeah, go to the police. So anyway, that's the story of the Toolbox Killers. May they both rest in pain. I told you that was a rough one.
That was a rough one.
You're like, why can't we just do Juliet present?
Thank you for making it, like, fast, though. I feel like it wasn't as painful as some of the other ones.
Oh, true. I'm not doing a two-parter on those fuckers.
They don't deserve it.
I just can't do it.
And they don't deserve this drink either. This drink was really good.
I know. This drink was bomb. And I loved it. Well, thank you guys for listening. Thanks, I know that was listening. A rough one, but I don't know. I think it's a good one to talk about because, you know, it's this weird conversation that I've had with Jason before. Where a lot of people, if you're not a woman, you don't know what it's like to navigate the world as a woman.
No.
You know what I mean? No. And so it's like he would travel for work and he'd say, oh, you know, why don't you go down into the bar and get some dinner? Like, why do you always eat dinner in your room? And it's like, okay, you don't understand what it's like to sit at the bar as a woman. Yeah. You know, it's like you kind of have to explain it. And I feel like these kind of stories just really drive home. You can't even walk home. You know, sometimes, and it's important. These stories are important to see and know. And I don't know. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I do.
I feel like I'm stumbling around.
No, I get it.
But it is true. It is true. Mm-hmm. So Even though they're rough, I think they need to be told. And especially because, you know, Cindy and Andrew have never been found. And the more that story is told, the likelihood of them being found is higher and higher mm-hmm. and higher. So
yeah.
Anyway, you guys, thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Tell them where to find us.
You can email us if you have recommendations for a story or a cocktail you'd like to see at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. We're also on TikTok at killerspiritspod. We're on Instagram at killerspiritspod. I think that's it. Is that everything?
Yeah, and make sure like and subscribe and leave us a review.
Leave us a thing. And another shout out to the last person who left us a review. Please hit us up and tell us where we can send you a sticker, because we want to send you a Killer Spirits podcast sticker. It's very cool. It has a skull and a cocktail on it.
Yeah. It does. It is very cool.
Oh, we're also on Patreon. Patreon.com/KillerSpirits.
Yeah, I feel like you were extra quiet in this episode.
It was gross.
I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like I've been talking for days.
And it's a 2-drink day, so.
That's for sure. All right, thank you guys so much.
Bye.